with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on sports networks. Availability varies by zip code and package. New customers. Service renews monthly unless you cancel. Choice package required. Restrictions apply.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. To listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Imagine you're accused of a murder you didn't commit. What's the worst alibi you could possibly have? It's the one with no eyewitnesses, right? It's the one that's impossible to prove and might even seem a bit too convenient. Now picture your dread as a detective leans across the interrogation table and asks, "Where were you on the morning of such and such a date, between 3 and 6 in the morning?" Your heart sinks, because your only answer is the honest one. "I was at home, asleep all night in bed by myself." It's an alibi like this that can put a person in the hot seat, even if they are telling the truth. Now imagine, investigators uncover a mountain of evidence showing the murder happened right outside your home. They also find a string of text messages between you and the victim, revealing an argument you'd had that very night. To make matters worse, the victim was supposed to be sleeping beside you that night, the mother of your infant child. Think about how far-fetched your alibi sounds now. This is exactly what happened to a father in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And as we know from so many other cases, proving someone didn't commit murder can sometimes be more difficult than proving they did. Join me now as we examine the murder of Nicole Vanderhaden, a mother of three who never came home after a night out with her partner and father of her child. You'll hear how a fun night out turned deadly after accusations of infidelity and the last-minute evidence that would verify a simple yet ironclad alibi, begging the question, if he didn't do it, then who did? The first 6 months of raising a child are like a whirlwind, with new parents immersed in a blur of feeding schedules, diaper changes, and sleepless nights, leaving little room for anything else. Well, in May 2019, 34-year-old Doug Dietrich from Green Bay, Wisconsin, was going through this very experience after he and his partner, 31-year-old Nicole Vanderhaden, had their first child together just 6 months earlier. Fortunately for Doug, Nikki was no stranger to the demands of parenthood, as she'd already had two children during a previous marriage. So whatever apprehensions Doug might have been feeling about being a new father were quickly erased by Nikki's confidence and expertise. It had only been about a month after Doug and Nikki started dating in 2015 when she first learned she was pregnant. But despite the big surprise, both Doug and Nikki were excited by the news, and a few months later, decided to move in together.
It was a good relationship, and always had, you know, had plans for future and everything like that. Raising Tyler, Michaela, and Dylan, and living together and raising the family and being part of a family. And, you know, we had talked about marriage and everything like that, but we had said with Dylan being born and didn't want to rush things prior to him being born. So we just took our time and said we were going to wait to talk about that, and once he was a little older, when he was old enough to kind of maybe walk down the aisle, that would be a possibility if we go that to that step.
Doug Dietrich came from a family of builders in the Green Bay area, and he worked for his father's contracting business. In fact, they'd even built the house that became Doug and Nikki's family home. Nikki, who was also from the area, had spent the last 6 years working as a substitute teacher. And although she had an education degree, Nikki preferred substituting because it gave her the flexibility to spend more time with her three kids. Still, even the most devoted mother needs a night off now and then. Time to recharge, have some fun, spend some quality time with their partner, away from the pacifiers, nursery rhymes, and dirty diapers. Well, on May 19th, it seemed Doug and Nikki had found their opportunity. Doug's friend Greg had invited them to join him and some old school friends for a night out at a local sports bar to watch the 80s glam metal band, Steel Panther. Known for their over-the-top and hyper-sexualized satire of 1980s hair bands, a band like Steel Panther was the antithesis of Doug and Nicole's newfound responsibilities as parents. And it all sounded like the kind of evening they could both really use. Nikki's older children were already scheduled to spend the weekend with her father. All they needed now was for someone to watch the baby. Nikki's mother agreed to stay until 11 p.m., at which time Nikki's friend Dallas would take over until the couple came home. It seemed everything had come together for one of Doug and Nikki's first nights out since the baby was born.
We left and we went and stopped at McDonald's because we hadn't, neither of us had eaten, and got some drive-through. Pretty much ate in the car as we were going to the show because it had already started, the opening bands or whatever that were performing. Got there, I think probably around 8 o'clock or so. And we parked and went into the show.
After finding Doug's friends at the bar, their group had a few beers, danced, and took selfies with the band in the background. When the show ended, they all decided they didn't want the night to end and made plans to hop to another bar. But as they were about to leave, Nikki realized Doug hadn't returned from the bathroom yet. Not wanting to leave Nikki alone, Doug's friend Aaron asked her if she wanted to catch a ride with him to the Sardine Can, the place everyone had agreed to meet at. After sending Doug a series of text messages, Nikki decided to go with his friends. It seemed Doug and his friend Greg had run into another group of friends from school they hadn't seen in years, and he said he'd catch up with Nikki later. When Doug finally headed over to the Sardine Can, he realized he'd missed a flurry of text messages from Nikki, wondering where he was. And they were fueled with anger that read, "So what bit you with? F you, abusive asshole. Wow, what slut are you with? Because none of your friends know." When Doug saw the messages, he was confused. Why was Nikki accusing him of cheating? He'd only been chatting with some old school friends. Surveillance footage from the Sardine Can shows Nikki attempting to have a good time with Doug's friends, singing, dancing, and drinking. But on the inside, she was becoming increasingly fed up with Doug's absence. When Nikki tried calling Doug, he didn't pick up. But when his friend called him, he did, which only made Nikki even more upset. Why was he picking up for his friend but not her? Doug had now left Nikki alone with his friends for over an hour, and she wasn't happy. This was not how she'd envisioned her first night out in months with him to go. By that point, Doug's friends were already ready to move to another bar, and when Doug still hadn't shown up, they decided to leave anyway and invite Nikki to join them. But when they called an Uber and got ready to leave, Nikki walked off down the street alone. That's when Doug's friend Aaron Kalinske ran after her and tried convincing her to come back and join them.
I just decided to go after her and see if I could corral her back. And I saw her, she looked over her shoulder and saw I was coming after her, so she full out sprinted. So I full out sprinted, caught up to her about another half block up. I could tell she was crying. I was like, it's okay. And let's just get you back home to your child. She didn't want anything to do with it. She just became combative and kind of pushing me away. And then I continued a little longer, but then she kind of did like this dead weight thing and fell to the ground, was continuing to cry and kind of hitting me in my legs and stuff. She was striking at me, screaming at the top of her lungs. I knew there was people across the street at a bonfire, and I just looked over there and I just saw all faces looking at me. So I just backed off and helped her up, and she kept on going up Howard.
At the exact same time Nikki left the sardine can, Doug and Greg had finally decided to leave the watering hole.
I did get a hold of Nikki, and that is when I talked to her, and she was not making any sense. And I was, you know, trying to calm her down and diffuse, you know, and try to say there's nothing to be, what's wrong, you know? Nothing to be upset about. I'm on my way to see you. Sorry it took so long. And I don't think she was listening to anything I had to say. And I said, here, Greg, you try to talk to her. She's not making any sense. And she wasn't happy. And I was, you know, just saying, just let me know where you are. We'll come pick you up. You know, we're drunk. Let's go home, you know. If you want to go home, you want to go, tell me where you want to go. And I don't think she heard a word or was listening to anything I had to say.
After arriving at the sardine can around 1 a.m., Doug asked around to see if anyone had seen Nikki while making several attempts to call her. But by that point, Nikki's phone was already turned off. It was just before 3 a.m., when Greg drove Doug home, and to his surprise, Nikki wasn't there. When he asked Dallas, who'd been watching their son, to try contacting Nikki since she wasn't responding to him, Dallas got no response either.
I was starting to get a little more concerned, you know, where she is. You know, I figured she'd be coming home that night, and you know, I was kind of, you know, getting a little worried that she wasn't going to come home, but, you know, maybe this she was pretty intoxicated and going to be staying somewhere else and was going to be, you know, to come home in the morning. Went upstairs, got ready for bed, took out my contacts, brushed my teeth as I do every night, and went back downstairs, made an ice water, and then went to bed. And I remember laying in bed, and I called Dallas shortly after 3 o'clock and talked to her, and she said she had not heard from Nikki at that point yet.
Doug only slept about 3 hours before the baby's cries from the bassinet woke him up. It was feeding time, and Nikki was still nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, I was wondering where she was kind of at that point. You know, it's getting a little later in the morning. You know, I figured she slept at a friend's house. She was, you know, going to sleep in because she had been drinking a lot that night and probably felt the same as I did at that point. Hungover and needed to sleep it off. And I was really getting concerned at that point, you know. And then I contacted Greg, my parents, I contacted Dallas. I think Dallas had mentioned if she was in jail, checked the jail records, did an inmate search to see if she was possibly in jail.
Despite his growing concern for Nikki's whereabouts, Doug was also acutely aware of his own hangover. He knew that Nikki, who rarely drank, had matched him drink for drink during the concert. It was entirely possible she was still sleeping it off somewhere. But as the day dragged on, that seemed less likely. At 4:30 p.m., Doug decided it was time to call police and report Nikki missing. After a detective arrived, Doug was questioned for the next 2 hours about the previous night, where he freely discussed everything that had happened, even showing the detective his phone to back up his story and verify his timeline. But there was something the detective knew before arriving at Doug and Nikki's home, Nikki had already been found. In a field just 3 miles away, a local farmer out working had discovered something horrific. A body of a deceased female.
When we went in between there was a wooden fence post laying in the field that I got off and picked it up and just threw it over the hill. And then I was kind of looking in and I said, the boys were further that way from me. He said, is that a dead deer down there? And they were looking at a different, from the angle they were at, they could see perfect. They said, no, that's a body. And then I told them to get the hell out of there.
I dialed 911. The officer said to walk away. And then I didn't get as far as the lane, and he was in the yard already, and then I took him back to where he could look at it, and he asked me if I touched anything, and I said no. Then he said to go back by the vehicle.
By the time the detective had finished interviewing Doug about the previous night, members of both his and Nikki's family had arrived to help coordinate a search for Nikki. But as they were getting ready to leave the house, a news report about a body found in a field was broadcast on TV.
Everybody just started freaking out and like, oh my God. And I think my mom said, stay positive. And everybody was crying, stressful. And it was this, it was just a blur. And one officer, the detective, or I think it was Kingston, said that the body he found did have a pink bracelet on from the concert, and that I lost it at that point. I just wanted to go and give my dad and mom hugs, and we just, this was a wreck blur after that. Because I was trying to hold out any hope that wasn't Nikki at there, that they had found, and that like pretty much confirmed it to me.
Nicole's body had been discovered face down, wearing only her socks, and she'd been severely beaten. So severe that dental records were needed to confirm her identity. A forensic pathologist would later determine she'd sustained a total of 241 wounds, with fractures to her jaw and skull, and evidence of strangulation with a ligature. An autopsy would also conclude that Nikki had been the victim of a vicious sexual attack. But it wouldn't be until the next morning that Sheriff's Deputy Nicholas Merritt would find their first clue while driving home from the police station.
Yeah, at first I thought it was what appeared to be a dead animal on the right side of the road, heading up the ramp onto 172 westbound. When I got closer, I noticed it was what appeared to be a pile of clothes or a clothing item on the right side of the road. I did not stop at that time. By the time I got to the clothing, I was already near highway speeds and didn't really recollect what it was until a little bit down the road, or what I thought it could be. About a mile and a half, 2 miles up the road, I thought that I better contact the shift lieutenant to see if anyone on duty could check in case it was in fact the clothing from the victim.
And it turned out Sheriff's Deputy Merritt was right. What he'd spotted had been a pile of clothing. Nikki's clothing, including her shirt, pants, underwear, bra, shoes, and purse, most of them covered in blood. Their next clue would be found the following day, May 23rd, when the murder weapon was found. A cord-coated cable used to strangle Nikki, found in the front yard of Doug Dietrich's neighbor, Matthew Peterson.
I went out to mow my lawn at about 10 in the morning and came upon an area in front of my yard that had a significant amount of blood. It was abutting the curb, the very, very front of the yard, almost directly in front of my home. I did proceed to begin mowing my lawn, and in the very first pass of mowing my lawn close to the curb, I heard a click. It sounded like my blade of my lawnmower hitting something. And I shut my lawnmower off and found a piece of cord. I picked it up and it looked a lot like the cords running along my lawnmower. So I initially thought that something had fallen off of my lawnmower. I inspected my lawnmower, tried to start it. It started just fine. At that point, I decided that the cord was a piece of garbage or something that had flown off of somebody's vehicle, and I just set it on the curb to pick up later, and I subsequently forgot to pick it up and proceeded to mow my lawn.
At first, Matthew assumed the blood in his yard and on the street was from an animal being hit by a passing car. But when he heard the news of Nikki's disappearance and murder, he suspected something far more sinister and reported it to the police. A forensic examination would later conclude that the blood on the ground and on the cord was indeed Nikki's. At the sheriff's office, Doug was the primary suspect from the start. He'd admitted he'd argued with Nikki just before her murder, and interviews with friends and family revealed their relationship hadn't been going very smoothly lately. That same month, Doug told his mother he was thinking about asking Nikki and her kids to move out. To make matters worse for Doug, the crime scene and murder weapon was discovered right outside his house. During a search of his home, police also found more alarming evidence, including what appeared to be blood on the garage floor, inside Nikki's car, and on a pair of Doug's old shoes. With all this evidence now in hand, police had more than enough to arrest Doug on suspicion of murder and showed up on his doorstep to do just that.
Right now I'm going to be taking you into custody. I'll be handcuffing you. I'll explain all that to you in a bit and transporting you down to the sheriff's department. Okay?
Okay.
Be cooperative with me.
All right.
And we'll roll it that way.
Wow, okay.
All right. I'm going to get you down there and we'll talk down there and I'll kind of explain to you what's going on. I'm a decent guy.
Okay, I'm a decent guy too.
I get that. I'm sure you are. You seem like a real nice guy.
Before officially charging Doug with murder, police decided to wait for the results of the forensic testing to come back. And while they waited for the test results, Doug awaited his fate in jail for 18 days, missing Nikki's funeral. Although the police were confident they had the right man, everything changed when the lab results came back, and Doug's DNA wasn't found on the cord used to strangle Nikki or on her neck. It also wasn't a match to any other blood found at his home. In fact, the blood found on Doug's shoes was from a turkey hunting trip. The blood in Nikki's car was from one of her children. And the blood on the garage floor was just a dark stain. While this new information didn't exonerate Doug, it also didn't provide enough evidence to charge him, and he was released from jail. But the forensic tests hadn't led to a complete dead end. DNA testing revealed a partial profile to someone other than Doug, an unknown male whose DNA was found on almost all the evidence, including the murder weapon. A profile that also appeared on Nikki's body and clothing as well. And when this DNA profile was entered into the system, it came back with a match to 38-year-old George Birch from Virginia, a man with a violent criminal history. Investigating George, police discovered he was a recent transplant to Green Bay with a shady past, including theft and thuggery, even once standing trial for murder in 1998, but was found not guilty. Standing 6'7 and weighing 270 pounds, George had arrived in Green Bay about 3 months before Nicole's murder. An old friend, Ed Jackson, had allowed George to live with him and his wife and use his 1999 red Chevy Blazer. Well, several weeks after Nicole's murder, and while Doug was still in jail, Green Bay officers had been called out to Ed Jackson's house on June 8th to investigate an alleged auto theft with that very same red Chevy Blazer.
About 7:30 a.m., I was dispatched to an auto theft complaint. I spoke with Edward Jackson. One of his vehicles was stolen overnight, a 99 Chevy Blazer. Ed told me the last person that drove the vehicle was George Stephen Birch. He indicated he had used the vehicle the previous night And after he was done using it, he drove home, parked it in the driveway, and must have left it unlocked with the keys on it, because this morning it was missing. That morning it was missing. And while investigating the auto theft complaint, I spoke with one of my lieutenants, came to the scene, and he was able to find information that the vehicle was involved in a hit-and-run accident.
It turned out that the Blazer not only had been involved in a hit-and-run, it had also been discovered completely torched and burned out from a fire. The interior, a little more than ashes and melted seats. In order to prove his whereabouts and that he'd had nothing to do with the crimes, George allowed police to take his cell phone.
He gave us permission to look at his text messages. And at that point, I asked him if I could just take his phone to the department, have one of our analysts download the information off the phone just to make it easier to search through all the information.
Ultimately, police couldn't determine what had happened to the Blazer. Although they suspected George was behind both the hit and run and the vehicle fire, they lacked the evidence to prove it and couldn't make an arrest or file any charges. But as luck would have it, all the data from George's cell phone remained in police custody. So when investigators later found George's DNA on Nikki's sock, they realized they might be able to use the phone data to track his whereabouts on the night of Nikki's murder. And when they examined his location data from the morning of May 21st, they couldn't believe what they found.
I observed Mr. Birch's phone being at a bar on South Broadway. I observed Mr. Birch's phone traveling south down Broadway into De Pere. I observed Mr. Birch's phone traveling to Ms. Vanderhagen's residence on Berkeley. I observed Mr. Birch's phone traveling to the site where the body was found. I observed Mr. Birch's phone leaving the site where the body was found and traveling west on 172 and ultimately ending up back at his residence on Greenwood.
The evidence was damning. George had been at a bar next to the sardine can the night of the murder and outside Nikki's home just after 3 a.m. He was also at the field where her body was found and at the location her clothes were discarded. It was the kind of evidence detectives refer to as the smoking gun. And on September 7th, 2016, George was arrested for Nikki's murder.
So obviously you're brought here in handcuffs, right? Which means you're arrested, so you have the right to your Miranda rights. Are you familiar with those rights at all? The reason you're here is in reference to a homicide investigation into Nicole Vanderhagen. Okay? So, is this something that you want to talk to me about?
Sir?
What's that? You don't want to talk to me about that? So if I read your Miranda rights, you don't want to talk to me?
So I prefer a lawyer.
Okay. What's going to happen now is I'm going to call for a squad. You're going to be transported to the jail on the charges of homicide. Okay.
George, who'd had frequent run-ins with the law, knew better than to talk to detectives without a lawyer present and maintained his innocence until his trial in 2018. Surprisingly, George and his defense team didn't try to discredit a lot of the prosecution's evidence. Instead, they admitted George was at all those critical locations surrounding the morning of Nikki's murder. They even acknowledged his DNA being found on Nikki's body and her clothes. It was a strategy that stunned the courtroom until George took the stand in his own defense. When it became clear, George had a story to explain everything, and he claimed to know who the real killer was. He began his testimony by stating he met Nikki in the early morning hours at his favorite bar, Richard Cranium's.
I don't know if I was watching TV or what it was, or talking amongst friends around me, but I noticed there was a fairly attractive blonde woman standing next to me. She was standing and she didn't seem to be with anybody. She was by herself. And I just kind of struck up a conversation. She was right like, in the vicinity, right next to me. We sat there and talked for a while. We both expressed that we had been through marriages. I told her I have kids. She told me she had kids from marriages. I don't remember if she said separated or divorced. I told her that I was going through the current situation myself. We standing there talking, having a conversation. I could understand everything she was saying. She wasn't sloppy drunk or anything like that. I didn't notice her stumble or anything.
Richard Craniums was located just a half mile south of the sardine can, in the direction Nikki had last been seen walking by Doug's friends.
Well, I moved a little closer to her, just talking, laughing, joking, giggling, you know, light touch here or there, just things that you can pretty much tell if someone's kind of into you, I guess is would be the best way to put it. They call last call, let you order some drinks, and pretty much tell you to get the hell out when it's time to go. We proceeded to leave through the back. I invited her back to my place. She walked to my vehicle, I opened the passenger door. She got in the passenger door, I shut the door, and went around to the driver's side and got in my Blazer. We went back to my house right down the street.
According to George, when he and Nikki walked to his place, one of his roommates was still awake and sitting in the living room, which threatened to kill the mood. So Nikki suggested they head over to her house. George claimed Nikki directed him as he drove the red Chevy Blazer to her place, the same Chevy that would be later destroyed in a fire. When they arrived at Nikki's, George said they could tell someone was inside, so they decided to park in front of Nikki's neighbor's house.
She said there was a light on and she thought the babysitter was still up. We sat there and talked for a few minutes. Started fooling around, messing around a little bit. Started kissing. I was kissing her neck a little bit, touching each other. Things we were doing before kind of, I guess you could say, escalated.
According to George's location data, they would have arrived at Nikki's house only about a minute after Doug arrived and the babysitter left. George then said Nikki climbed into the back seat and took off her clothes. Because George was too big to fit in the back seat with her, he said he left the rear passenger door open and stood outside with his pants around his ankles. Then, everything went black.
The next thing that I remember, apart from us having intercourse, was literally waking up on the ground outside the truck, laying in the like grass curb area. I'm not certain, but I felt like I was rustled or something. I was hit or something made me aware of my surroundings all of a sudden. And I remember waking up going, what in the hell? At first I didn't know what was going on. I looked down and I'm laying on the ground and my pants are around my ankles, literally. And I was a little groggy trying to, you know, kind of put two and two together, what the hell was going on. I kind of grabbed my pants and went to kind of move. And that's when I pretty much noticed something was going on behind me. Eventually I realized it was a person standing behind me. The first thing I heard was, don't even think about it. It's the first things I ever heard, like the first words I heard. I didn't know what to do. Kind of tried to gather myself together as much as I possibly could. I saw what looked like a man standing with a firearm in his hand.
Because it was so dark and the man was standing behind him, George said he couldn't see the person's face.
Then I was instructed to move to the back end of the vehicle. I noticed someone or something laying in the back behind the truck or behind the Blazer. I looked closer and I realized that it was Nicole laying there. I didn't know if she was alive. There was a lot of blood on her face, coming out of her mouth, on her back. But she wasn't physically moving. But it kind of freaked me out even farther when seeing this, because she was literally, from what I remember the last time, we were in the car having sex. And the next thing I know, she's literally laying on the concrete right in front of me. The person behind me, I could hear them say, was, look what the f*** you made me do.
George claimed the gunman then forced him to place Nikki's body into the back seat of the Blazer. He was then instructed to get back into the driver's seat while the man sat in the back, a gun pointed at him the entire time.
Once I started the vehicle, you have your interior lights, and the interior lights were bright enough that I could actually see someone. I could see the reflection in the mirror, because I couldn't physically turn around and look at him. It was that Beatrice.
Although George had no idea who it was at the time, he said he was now 100% confident that Doug Dietrich was the man holding him at gunpoint. According to him, Doug instructed him to drive the dark roads until they came to a field where they turned in. He was then forced to carry Nikki's body to the edge of the field.
That's when I turned, and with everything I had, I lunged at him and pushed him as hard as I possibly could. He stumbled backwards. Did he fall down? I don't know, because I hauled ass to my car, or my truck. I jumped in the vehicle, started it, and I remember to try to take off, but when I took off, if you slam it down too fast, it doesn't lock and drive. So I actually ended up slamming it down to a lower gear at first, because I remember when I turned off, I came around and went to the dirt road, and I remember it was bucking. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I noticed that it wasn't in drive. That was the whole reason why I couldn't go anywhere.
Even though George made his exit in low gear, driving approximately 5 miles an hour, according to the location data, he claimed that Doug never shot at him as he fled. But as George drove home, he said he realized all of Nikki's clothing and belongings were still in the truck.
I remember looking over and seeing some stuff that was hers sitting in the vehicle. Honestly, I freaked out and I threw it out the window.
Instead of calling police immediately to report what had happened, George claimed he decided not to tell anyone.
I didn't even know who to talk to. How do you have a conversation with someone about something like that? Like, what do you say? I grew up an only child, and I've experienced a lot of things that sometimes you just keep them inside. And it just, now I see that it's completely wrong, and I should have said something or should have done something. But in the time, I kind of imploded and kept everything inside. I was scared to speak to the cops. Where I'm from, you don't talk. You don't tell about things you've seen. You don't tell on people. People get killed all the time where I'm from for that. And I feared for my own safety if I would have ever said anything, because like I said, where I'm from, it happens all the time. People go to tell on people and tell things, and they end up dead. They never make it to court. They never make it anywhere. They find them dead.
The following day, George said he woke up and went out on a planned fishing trip with a friend and didn't mention anything that had happened. Not to his friend or anyone else until the day he spoke with lawyers after his arrest. It became evident to the prosecution that George had constructed a narrative to align with the physical evidence presented to the jury. Now, it was the prosecution's job to show how George's story, while clever and incredibly imaginative, was still full of holes.
When we got there, the light was on. She said the babysitter was up.
Why would that be a problem? Why wouldn't you just ask the babysitter to go home and go inside?
Sir, I don't know. I've never been in her house. I don't know her babysitter.
So Nicole would rather have sex with you in front of her neighbor's home with your butt hanging out the door of the car than ask the babysitter to go home?
Sir, I don't know. I wasn't the one making decisions.
During cross-examination, it became clear the prosecutor was getting under George's skin.
That was your expectation. You were going to have sex. That's why you're driving her home, right?
I was hoping that we would. It was leading from what had happened before and where we had spoken. It seemed like that's what was going to happen.
When you get there and it becomes clear that Nikki isn't going to have sex with you, when she attempts to go into her house and leave your vehicle, that's when your mood changes, right?
No, sir.
That's when things get aggressive, don't they?
Not at all.
That's when you grab that cord and strangle her, don't you?
No, sir, not at all.
That's when Nikki gets slammed on the ground repeatedly when she's trying to run toward her house, when those bloodstains lead in the direction back to her home.
None of that is true.
Well, how do you know? You were out cold when Nikki was assaulted.
Because you said I did it.
On more than one occasion, the judge was forced to intervene and ask both the witness and the prosecutor to keep their exchange civil.
And you'll have the jury believe that Doug Dietrich sat there and did all of these things to his girlfriend while you were just out cold on the lawn hanging out.
I wasn't hanging out. I'd been knocked out from behind, sir. but I didn't know anyone was behind me.
Actually, you didn't say you were knocked out from behind. You didn't remember what happened. You were having sex, and the next thing you knew, you woke up on the ground, right?
It made me lead me to believe that I had been knocked out because I didn't pass out from standing there.
But you don't recall any pain, so how do you know?
I didn't recall any pain until later on that day when I got out of the situation and was not completely all worked up.
And then you only recall just maybe a small little bump on the back of your head.
I remember being painful in the back of my head.
Not even a bump. Because that Jackson would have seen that.
I'm 6'7", so it's hard for someone to see the top of my head.
When they're sitting on a boat within 10 feet from you all afternoon?
That I don't know, sir, what he saw.
Not only had George crafted a narrative to prove his innocence, he was now also accusing Doug of being the real murderer, with George's defense relying heavily on the fact that Doug had been the detective's original primary suspect. He'd even been arrested for the crime. Fortunately for the prosecution, they discovered surprising data while preparing for George's trial. Reviewing footage of Doug's original police interviews, they noticed he wore a Fitbit on his wrist during each interview, a device that continuously measures physical activity and could potentially validate Doug's alibi. And it did. After downloading data from Doug's tracking app and analyzing his activity between 3 and 7 a.m. on the morning of the murder, the data supported Doug's alibi. Between those hours, Doug's tracker registered only 12 steps, consistent with bathroom trips or restless sleep. These 12 steps were crucial to proving Doug hadn't removed the Fitbit during the murder, as it recorded typical sleep-related activity. Unless the Fitbit data was corrupt or unreliable, it definitely exonerated Doug from Nikki's murder. So if it wasn't Doug, there was only one conclusion. George Birch was lying. During closing arguments, the prosecution honed in on the totality of damning evidence against George.
Who has been proven to have been with Nikki in the last hours of her life on May 21st, 2016, in those early morning hours? Who has been proven unequivocally to have been with her? Whose DNA is on her sock? The sock he left behind on her battered body? Who's with Nikki at the four key areas of Brown County? With this location evidence, with him at the area of the sardine can, Berkeley Street, the field on Hoffman, and 172 where her clothing and personal property is, and the DNA hit, ladies and gentlemen, we could have rested at that point. We have the presence of the defendant's DNA where it should not be. He meets Nikki at Richard Cranium's. He's a stranger, he doesn't know her. What's he tell you? She's flirting with him. What's he say? You can tell someone's into you. Clearly, this 6'7" hunk of man could not be resisted. You saw his picture. What was a girl to do? What were Nikki's choices?
The prosecutor then pointed out that general absurdity in George's story.
He told you she didn't seem to be with anyone. She was by herself. He saw her as prey, somebody to move in on. He had one thing in mind, and it was not giving her a ride home. Think about it. They both wanted consensual sex. They would have gone to his house, to his home, where he had a room, 2.5 blocks, he says, from Richard Cranium's, where he had privacy, where he was allowed to bring home women and did it on other occasions. Oh, but no, there was an elderly gentleman in the house at the time in the living room. But no, they don't have sex there. They don't go to a hotel. No, it's on to Berkeley. And she obviously had to tell him how to get there. He didn't know where it was. She obviously gave him directions because she thought he was taking her home to her child, to the father of her child, to her home.
But it was George's next statement that the prosecution contended was proof he was making everything up.
What did he tell you that Nikki said? He claimed Nicole told him there was a light on and the babysitter was there. Nicole would never have made that statement. There was no car in the driveway or in the street. Dallas's vehicle was not there. Nikki would have not said, oh, the babysitter's still there. Dallas testified she'd gone already. She left around 3 a.m., right before they got there. There was no vehicle to be seen. She's friends with Dallas. She knew her car. She would never have said, oh, the babysitter's here. There's a light on. She would have seen the car was gone, and she would have probably assumed that Doug was home. He makes this statement up. He makes up this account. This whole thing is made up. And that statement there points out that Nikki didn't say that because none of this happened.
It wasn't just circumstantial reasoning that disproved George's theory. The prosecution pointed to the obvious evidence of a violent sexual attack.
You don't need a medical degree to draw the same conclusion Dr. Rogalska did, that this was suggestive of a sexual assault. The evidence and the injuries suggestive of a sexual assault. This was a forceful penetration. It would have been a painful penetration. It was a rape. Why do we know that she did not choose to have sex with this defendant? It's because of the location. You're not going to have sex in front of your neighbor's house and near your own home, where your father, your child, may be right around the corner. Great place for a romantic tryst, the back of the blazer, where he says he barely fits. Well, wait, let's make it even better. Let's open the doors so the show gets even better for the neighborhood. It's an absurd account for something that's supposed to have been consensual, because it wasn't.
The prosecution also called into question George's fantastical account of how he got away from Doug at gunpoint.
When the man has him at gunpoint, some 5 feet away, but he's able to lunge, push as hard as I could, and haul ass, as he says it, to his truck, which is 10 to 15 feet away. Bullets don't fly. They can't cross the distance faster than him running. Gets in there, no shots fired at the car, and he puts it in low gear, and still, Doug Dietrich lets him go, the witness to the murder. And then after this frightening near-death experience, drives home, goes to bed, doesn't call anyone, sends no aid to Nikki, who he doesn't even know is dead, and is laying in a field. Doesn't call 911, goes to sleep, sleeps in, he's awakened by Ed the next day, goes fishing. But he's got an explanation for that, ladies and gentlemen, because from where he comes from, you don't talk. You don't tell on people. I feared for my own safety I could end up dead. Well, let's think about that. You're the only one who knows who the true killer is. You could identify that true killer and take him off the streets. But no, you run the risk you'll just bump into him again in Green Bay, where you continue to visit for months, and you don't reveal what you know. You could make yourself safe by making sure the police had the right man, and you give them the evidence they need to convict.
But the prosecutor saved her best argument for last, because there was still one more piece of evidence that completely disproved George's testimony.
Nikki's clothes prove beyond all doubt that the defendant's account is total fiction, because they show you her clothes were on her when she was killed. All of that blood was from the stomping and the injuries that were on her when she was killed. They're not off, as the defendant would have you believe, because they're having sex in the car, and then she's killed. The clothing tells a different story. The blood stains destroy the defendant's story. She wasn't killed after having sex and after her clothes were already off.
If George's story were true, Nikki would have been murdered after her clothing was already taken off. When Nikki's bloodstained clothing was shown to the jury, it became obvious she must have been still wearing her clothes when she was being savagely beaten. Mixed in with the blood was grass, dirt, and blonde strands of Nikki's hair. After deliberating for approximately 3 hours, the jury returned with a unanimous verdict.
The verdict reads as follows. We, the jury, find the defendant, George Stephen Birch, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide, is charged in the information. It is signed by our foreperson and dated this first day of March, 2018.
When it came to sentencing, the judge read aloud a number of letters he'd received from Nikki's friends and family.
When I think about the fact that George Birch came to Wisconsin and in less than 6 months left a trail of death and destruction, that is unacceptable. What chance did he give Nikki? Scars that have been inflicted run very deep. Dylan will never know who his mother was. Doug was arrested for something he had nothing to do with. These families have gone through hell and back many, many times. I received a second set of letters talking about Nikki and how she made life fun, gave happiness everywhere she went. There's a letter here that says, Nikki showed me how to be an amazing parent, how to keep smiling even through hard times. We've all lost piece of our hearts that we will never get back. Nikki was a strong, smart, interesting person, and she had a tremendous amount of patience. All those letters were written on behalf of Cole Vanderheim. I didn't receive any letters on behalf of Mr. Birch, which in some ways is sad and maybe telling.
In Wisconsin, judges are allowed to determine the appropriate period of no parole for first-degree murder. So in this case, it was up to the judge alone to decide if George would ever be eligible for release.
Well, what complicates things, though, is not only did you just brutally murder her, but you took away her life, and then you kind of tried to take away her reputation by this story of sex in the car. So now what is the appropriate sentence? What if this was a death penalty state? See, we haven't had the death penalty here since 1853. The answer is yes, Mr. Birch. This is a crime that would, I believe, merit the death penalty, and for that, you have to die in prison.
With these words, George Birch was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In the wake of Nicole's murder, her family has been completely devastated by her loss. Her two oldest children now live with their biological father, and their infant son continues to be raised by Doug. In a genuine display of grief for all the harm caused to Nikki's family, the judge held up a framed portrait of Nicole. Doug and their son articulate just how tragic the entire situation really was.
How many photos are like this in our community? You know, thousands, with thousands of families like this. And this family is destroyed. It's ruined. It'll never be like this again. What about the impact on Nicole, and who was a teacher, one of the most honorable professions there is, who was a teacher because she enjoyed seeing kids learn things. She was a good person, but most importantly, she was very good at the most important job any of us can ever have, and that's being a parent. As a parent to three beautiful children, including little Dylan, she was a loving and active mother. We heard about that today. Look what it's done to her parents. A parent should never have to bury a child. Sometimes it happens, but never should they ever have to do that under these circumstances. Today she said, we are shells of what we used to be. And then little Dylan, who'll never remember his mother. I have seen a child of one of those murder victims in court a number of times. They have struggled their entire life because their parent was brutally taken away from them. And my prayer is that these children don't suffer that fate, that they are strong.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @MadnessPod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.
Months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.